Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 46, Heretics, Jews, and Pagans. We've spent the last several episodes looking within the early church. Today, we shift gears completely and look at those outside, heretics, Jews, and pagans. We'll start by looking back at all the heresies that have sprung up in our narrative, why they are important, and what their situation was around the year 300 AD. Second, we'll look at Judaism, from the world of the Second Temple to the emergence of Rabbinic Judaism, the form of Judaism which still forms the basis of that faith today. Finally, we'll look at the Greco-Roman world. What did pagans think of Christianity, and how did their viewpoints change over time? This question will become front and center for us once the narrative resumes, and Diocletian makes the fateful decision to repress Christianity. Heretics and heresies have played a prominent role in our narrative since the time of the Apostle Paul. We've seen dramatic episodes such as Marcion's excommunication from the Church of Rome in the 2nd century, to the large councils of Antioch over its controversial bishop, Paul of Samosata. For ancient Christian historians such as Eusebius, heresy played an important role in their narratives. Their aim was primarily apologetic. Eusebius and others strove to prove historically that orthodoxy was the original pure faith of the apostles, and that heresies sprang up as deviations from that original faith. With respect to Eusebius and others, however, this somewhat simplistic narrative of the relationship between orthodoxy and heresy is not generally accepted by modern historians. Perhaps the most well-known and radical alternative put forward by modern scholarship is the so-called Bauer thesis, named after the 20th century German scholar Walter Bauer, famous for his contributions to New Testament Greek lexicography. In his 1934 book Orthodoxy and Heresy in Earliest Christianity, Bauer argued that what came to be labeled as heresy by the early church was in many regions regarded as orthodox and even predated the later establishment of what became orthodoxy. To put it a bit more bluntly, Bauer proposed that what became orthodoxy was not the original pure faith of the earliest followers of Christ, but simply the one faction in a seething mixture of religious factions which won out and could retroactively claim it had always been the original true faith. According to the Bauer thesis, the very notion of an original pure faith was itself historically fanciful, as Christianity had always been diverse from its earliest days. In its totality, the Bauer thesis is not widely accepted today by most scholars, but key elements of it have certainly had a profound effect on the study of early Christianity. First and foremost is the emphasis on diversity. Christian practice and belief could vary from region to region, sometimes quite significantly. I'm sure many of you remember the Quarto Deciman controversy which raged in the late 2nd century over when to celebrate Easter. Also, in some regions, what we may call heretical, or at the very least non-normative Christianity, did in some ways precede what would be considered orthodox. The best example of this is Alexandria. Despite being such a pivotal player in the early church, it was not until the end of the 2nd century that the Catholic Christian community in the Egyptian capital came into its own, whereas the great Gnostic teachers like Valentinus and Basilides had already planted their followers almost a century earlier. However, despite these insights from the Bauer thesis, most historians recognize that it goes too far, and a more nuanced approach is required. While overemphasis on unity can create a false picture of early Christianity as a monolithic movement, an overemphasis on diversity, or even disunity, can also lead to a skewed picture, especially by ignoring and downplaying the very real efforts early Christians made to keep their churches in contact and unified in faith. We've seen examples of this in Irenaeus and Dionysius of Alexandria. After all, even a pagan critic like Celsus could recognize the difference between the great church and other versions of Christianity. It also ignores the continuities between the great church and the apostolic age. It must be said that there is much more in common between the theology of the Apostle Paul and the church father Irenaeus than between Paul and the early Gnostics. What the Bauer thesis really does bring to light, however, is how much what became defined as orthodoxy was shaped by dialogue and controversy over what became defined as heresy. Orthodoxy was not some perfectly defined entity continuously passed from generation to generation. Rather, challenges from rival voices and disagreements within forced the great church to further reflect upon its theology and more clearly define just what exactly it believed. Many theological questions past generations had never considered became hot-button issues. Gnosticism had forced the great church to reckon with its doctrine of God as creator. Marcion made the Old Testament's scriptural status and the interpretation of Paul central elements to the identity of Orthodox Christianity. The controversies over adoptionism and modalism had done similar things to the Christological and Trinitarian theology of the early church. Orthodoxy was continuously redefined and reformulated as new ideas and controversies arose. Questions and even doctrines which had never before been considered suddenly became vital touchstones of Christian belief. This resulted in new terminology gaining currency within Christian circles as acceptable ways to express Christian belief. The concept of heresy was a peculiarly Christian notion. Of course, all religious communities have some limits to toleration in terms of differing beliefs. After all, without at least a small core of doctrines, a religious community has no real identity. But no other religious group in antiquity emphasized right belief as strenuously as the early Christians. Pagans had no issue participating in different cults, whether they be mystery cults, ancestral practices, or even civic religion. Jews, although they certainly held firm convictions and doctrines, were far less creedal than Christianity, and more concerned with proper religious practice. Christians, by contrast, debated proper doctrine as far back as the Apostle Paul's conflict with the Judaizers. Creeds were formulated and updated to provide a rule by which to measure correct belief. The reason for all of this was because early Christians believed that correct doctrine was essential for salvation. As such, heresy was a danger to one's immortal soul. The term heresy is a Greek word, heresis, which originally meant choice. It has been suggested that this term was associated in Greek philosophical circles with choosing a school of thought, such as that of Plato or Aristotle, and aligning oneself with that tradition. This is probably where the genealogical approach to heresy in the Church Fathers originated from. Writers like Justin, Irenaeus, Tertullian, and others often connected dots between various heretical teachers, seeing a succession of false teaching. Most especially, heretical groups were designated by identifying the founder of their school of thought, a heresiarch, and naming the members of that group after that heresiarch. Hence, the terms Valentinians, Marcionites, Montanists, Sabellians, etc. It was a good rhetorical way to delegitimize a wayward sect by not calling them Christians or Jesus followers, but instead followers of their heresiarch. This, of course, contrasted nicely with the terms used by the Church Fathers for their own people, apostolic and Catholic. We've covered heretics and heresy quite extensively in our narrative, so I won't repeat all that information here. At the close of the 3rd century AD, the major alternative Christianities to the Great Church were the Valentinian Gnostics, the Marcionites, and the Montanists. All three groups could be found in both the East and the West. These groups all had originated in the 2nd century, and maintained to varying degrees a measure of their own interconnectedness, like the Great Church. Montanists and Marcionites had their own ecclesiastical structures and bishoprics. In times of persecution, Montanists and Marcionite martyrs could be found alongside the Orthodox. Other groups, such as the Adoptionists, the Sabellians, and the followers of Paul Samosata, are less critical to our story as defined groups, but are hugely important in terms of the ideas they represented. Their heresies touched upon the foundational beliefs of Christianity, those about the Lord Jesus Christ himself. By the end of the 3rd century, the Great Church was certainly the mainstream Christian group compared to its rivals. However, the danger of heresy was always there, and it meant the church would have to continue to engage in dialogue and polemic against its rivals. Though they may not have recognized it, the early church fathers' theology was greatly benefited by these arguments with heretics. After the various heretical sects, the religious group closest to the early church was, of course, the Jews. The Christian church originated from Second Temple Judaism and continued to use the Hebrew scriptures as their own, albeit in translation. As our narrative has progressed, Jews and Judaism have featured less and less in our story, especially from the mid-2nd century onward. Though the role of Judaism will not necessarily increase in our story once the narrative resumes, it is still an important element. Therefore, I think it is a good idea that we circle back with an overview of Jewish history up to 300 AD. So what had the Jews been up to for the last three centuries? Twiddling their thumbs and waiting for the inevitable triumph of Christianity? Hardly. Following the destruction of the temple in 70 AD by the Romans, Judaism would undergo significant transformations which would in time lay the foundation for the future of the Jewish faith. The ultimate outcome of this transformation was Rabbinic Judaism, which is the foundation upon which nearly all subsequent strands of Judaism are based, up to the present day. This result was not a predetermined outcome, and the ascendancy of the rabbis did not happen overnight. The revolts against Rome in the diaspora and under Bar Kokhba in the early 2nd century demonstrated that the zealotry of the Second Temple era still remained, even after the destruction of Jerusalem. The central dilemma faced by Jewish thinkers was how to adapt to not having the temple anymore. The sacrificial cult of Yahweh, centered on Jerusalem, led by the Levitical priesthood, had been the defining element of the religion of ancient Israel going back a millennium. With the temple and the entire cultic apparatus gone, huge swaths of the Torah, particularly sacrificial, ceremonial, and priestly laws, became impossible to actually perform. The religion of Moses and the prophets, such as it was defined in the cultic practices of the Hebrew Bible, could not truly be practiced. As a result, the Jewish religion which came into existence after the temple's destruction was in many ways something new and different from the religion which preceded it. You may recall from one of our earlier episodes the story of Yochanan ben Zakkai. Ben Zakkai was a rabbi who, during the siege of Jerusalem, escaped the city and requested of the emperor Vespasian permission to establish a new Jewish center in the city of Jamnia, or Yavne, located on the coastal plain of Judea. The emperor granted the request, and Yavne was established as a center of the emerging rabbinic movement. Though the veracity of this story is questionable, It is important in that it shows the concern of the rabbinic movement to maintain a continuous link with the Second Temple period. Ben Zakkai serves as a transitional figure who originates in the old temple-centric period and bridges the gap into the new rabbinic age. Though often regarded as a sort of founding figure for rabbinic Judaism, we know relatively little about Ben Zakkai or his activities. Later traditions would, of course, ascribe much to him, which is historically debatable. The extent and scope of his impact beyond establishing Yavne as a religious center is difficult to discern. Ben Zakkai's successor, Rabban Gamaliel II, by contrast, is a much better attested figure. Gamaliel II was the grandson of the great Gamaliel the Elder. Gamaliel the Elder, of course, is the famous Pharisee and member of the Sanhedrin who interceded against executing the apostles, arguing that the New Jesus movement would fade out as other movements in Judea had before. The son of the elder Gamaliel and father of Gamaliel II was named Simon, and he played a critical role in the early stages of the great Judean revolt against Rome. The younger Gamaliel acted as the leader of the new Sanhedrin of his day. This position entailed some measure of Roman recognition. This recognition would eventually become a formalized office for Gamaliel's descendants who succeeded him. This role of Nasai, or Prince of the Sanhedrin, developed into the Jewish Patriarchate, an honorary Roman prefecture with secular and religious authority recognized by the imperial government. Gamaliel's tenure appears to have been heavily involved with liturgical and calendrical issues, as well as reestablishing normal relations with the Roman authorities. This included extensive traveling, including travels by Gamaliel and his colleagues to Rome itself as national representatives. These attempts, of course, were not immediately successful for the Jewish community at large, as the diaspora uprisings and Bar Kokhba War made clear. But with Bar Kokhba's last attempt for national autonomy, the military messianic fervor of the old zealotry finally began to fade away. It dawned on the Jewish people that the Messiah's coming was not imminent, and the temple's reconstruction would not happen anytime soon. The war left Judea proper a significantly less Jewish region than before. Jerusalem was now a pagan city named Aelia Capitolina, the province itself renamed Palestine, and even the Jewish Mother Church of Jerusalem largely disappears from the historical record at this time. Even Yavne to the north did not escape the effects of the Bar Kokhba War. Jerusalem and Judea were no longer the heartlands of Jewish religious life and leadership. Instead, the region of Galilee to the north assumed the mantle, especially in cities like Tiberias and Sepphoris. The leadership of the rabbinic movement continued to be led by the descendants of Gamaliel II as patriarchs. The office of patriarch would firmly crystallize under Gamaliel's grandson Judah, known as Judah HaNasai, or Judah the Prince. As patriarch, Judah had authority over the all-important business of the Jewish calendar and Jewish law courts, authority which was officially recognized by Rome. He held a prominent place over other rabbis and could dispatch them to different Jewish communities. He also served as the main representative of his people to the imperial government. Rabbinic law courts and schools became the defining institutions of Jewish life during the prince's patriarchate. It was also under Judah that rabbis transitioned from rural community figures into major members of the local cities and urban landscape. We saw elements of this in Origen's interactions with the Jews of Caesarea. With the messianic militancy of the previous century gone and a new working relationship with Rome, Jewish leaders and their communities took their place as prominent and important players in the cities of the empire. By far, the most well-known achievement of Judah was the Mishnah. The Mishnah was the first written redaction of rabbinic oral tradition, composed around the year 200 AD. Although technically anonymous, the text has been attributed to Judah the Prince since antiquity. The Mishnah is composed of six sections, or orders, each focused around a particular theme of topics. Each order contains opinions and traditions concerning different aspects of the Torah, some of which are attributed to different rabbis and others anonymous. The traditions range from back into the Second Temple period up to Judah's own time. The six orders deal with agriculture, festivals, marriage, torts or damages, the temple cult and holy things, and finally, ritual purity. Interestingly enough, the Jerusalem temple cult is the central theme of one of the six orders, despite it having been destroyed. This highlights a key aspect of how the rabbis were able to creatively innovate in order to revive Judaism. The practices associated with the temple could no longer be practiced, so now Jews should instead study them in place of practice. The centrality of Torah study was, of course, the heart of the rabbinic faith. This was not a new phenomenon, as even in the Second Temple period, Judaism had increasingly become a book-centric religion. But the loss of the temple removed any challenge to the preeminence of Torah study. And herein lies the great ingenuity of the rabbis. Aspects of Judaism, which could only be performed in the temple cult, were replaced with new religious practices. Perhaps most importantly was the question of atonement. Without the Jerusalem temple, how could the nation of Israel make atonement for sin? The rabbinic answer was to replace sacrifice with good deeds of loving kindness, as well as study and prayer. Daily scheduled prayers replaced the morning and afternoon sacrifices which had once been offered in the temple. Study of the Torah substituted for the actual practice of its cultic laws. The rabbis would in fact go further and teach that the oral tradition was in fact the oral Torah. Moses had received two sets of laws in Mount Sinai, the written Torah, the first five books of Holy Scripture, and the oral Torah, which was passed down from generation to generation. A somewhat similar concept to that of the Pharisees' belief that they inherited the teaching seat of Moses. Now, it should be stated that the rabbis were not wholly unaware of the nature of the claims they were making. There is a particularly interesting rabbinic story of how Moses was transported forward in time to the class of the famous Rabbi Akiva. However, Moses found he was unable to follow or recognize what Akiva was teaching. A humorous admission that, despite the claim that the oral Torah had been handed down since the days of Moses, Jewish oral tradition developed and changed over time in order to meet the needs of the community. It was important to establish a sense of organic continuity with the past, whether it be with Moses on Sinai or Yochanan ben Zakkai escaping the siege of Jerusalem. Despite all these claims to continuity, though, the changes introduced by the rabbinic movement ultimately produced a religion which was in many ways quite unlike the sacrificial cult of Yahweh once practiced in ancient Israel. Having now discussed heretics and Jews, we conclude this episode by discussing pagans. The conflict between paganism and Christianity will emerge center stage once the narrative resumes. As such, I think it is helpful we provide ourselves with a recap of pagan-Christian relations and what the situation was on the eve of the Great Persecution. The Romans first viewed the early Christians as a sect of the legal religion of Judaism. However, with Nero's decision to scapegoat Christians for the Great Fire of Rome in 64 AD, combined with the increased distance between non-Christian Jews and the early church, Christianity became an illegal faith. Although no general law or policy was initially laid down, Christians were subject to sporadic local persecutions for the next 200 years. Only occasionally were the emperors themselves directly involved, such as Trajan's rescript to Pliny, or Marcus Aurelius's rescript to the officials in Lugdunum. Persecution was not constant, but was a threat which constantly hung over the heads of Christians. The crime of atheism, the Christian refusal to worship the gods who protected the Roman Empire, was viewed as a threat to the wider pagan community, both local and the empire as a whole. Evangelism spread this atheism, which further threatened the Pax Deorum, the peace of the gods. Civic religious duty made conversion to Christianity in the cities of the Roman Empire dangerous. Added to this problem was a general ignorance about Christianity among both educated and common pagans. Christians in the 2nd century were accused of incest, adultery, and cannibalism. The apologists appear to have made some progress in educating the pagan world, as in the late 2nd century, intellectual pagan critics like Galen of Pergamum and the philosopher Celsus show accurate and precise knowledge of Christianity. This in turn led to Christianity gaining a measure of social respectability in the Greco-Roman world during the late 2nd and early 3rd centuries. Persecution still remained a threat, but now persons such as the Roman governor of Arabia and members of the imperial family were inviting Christians like Origen to discuss religion. Nevertheless, fundamental divides between pagans and Christians remained. Although many mystery cults like that of Cybele and Mithras offered the more personalized religious experience Christians claimed, public civic religion remained primary. Pagan piety was centered on the public act of sacrificing to the gods of the local community and the empire. Christianity was fundamentally an un-Roman cult in this regard. It was not a civic religion. The church's internal hierarchy and structure offered a rival to the Roman state as a transnational polity which demanded complete loyalty. A state within a state. Christianity was also new, though it claimed antiquity via its link to ancient Israel and Judaism. Christians did not keep the ritual laws of the Torah. Judaism, at least, was ancient. Celsus, as an eclectic thinker, was representative of the broader classical tradition. For him, Christianity's non-civic nature made it an illegitimate form of religion. True religion involved maintaining the ancestral rites passed down from antiquity, which placated the gods. Through the worship of the local gods, everyone indirectly worshiped the supreme god. Doctrines like the incarnation, resurrection, creation out of nothing, and the devil were unworthy of the supreme god. The idea that God created through sheer will, or descended to the earth as a mortal man, or that God had a rebellious evil spirit to deal with, were all far beneath God's dignity. Pagan critics like Galen and Celsus posed real intellectual challenges to the early church, and as a result, the early fathers had to defend this faith. This engagement with its pagan critics, like its debates with heretical rivals, was to the early church's benefit. It forced the church to define its beliefs in distinction to the pagan world, utilized the benefits of Greco-Roman philosophy, and buttressed its faith with reasonable arguments. With Gallienus' legalization of Christianity in 260, the stigma attached to the faith by virtue of its illegal status was removed. Christianity gained more respectability in Greco-Roman society and grew in greater numbers, even spreading deep into the countryside. No longer limited largely to the cities, the gospel was spreading to the rural pagan areas and finding new converts. As a result, though there were still pagans who staunchly detested Christianity and viewed it as a threat, relations on the ground between local pagans and Christians had improved significantly. Popular hostility had subsided to a significant degree. Christians were even participating actively in the imperial government, with emperors waiving the requirement for sacrifice. In the late 3rd century, few Christians would have guessed that they were on the precipice of the greatest persecution in their history. With that, we conclude our survey. Next episode, we will look at the internal life of the early church and explore topics like worship, clergy, and material culture. As always, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the History of the Early Church podcast, please leave a review on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you use. Reviews really do help the show grow. Be sure to send in your First Three Centuries series questions. You can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com, post a comment on the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast, or post a comment on the blog site, historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.